Hey everyone, welcome to the Pod Awareness Podcast, and thanks for joining me. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and YouTube, and also check us out at podawareness.org and on Instagram at podawareness_official. On Instagram, we are doing submissions for Pet of the Week, where you can submit your foster pet, and we'll pick one winner every month, and we'll give $200 to their choice of charity or foster. Thanks for watching, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Hey everyone, welcome to today's episode of the Paw Awareness Podcast. Today I have Julian Jabor with Pet Rescue Pilots with us today. And a really unique organization. I'm really excited to talk with you about it and what it is that you do. So go ahead, introduce yourself for our audience and what it is that you and your organization does.
Chris, thanks so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to talking to you about it and having, you know, read about the impetus and inspiration for starting this podcast. There really isn't a better place to be talking about what it is that we do, because you're right. Like, awareness is one of the biggest obstacles that faces rescue in general. A lot of people are unaware of what's really happening out there. And to be honest, I was unaware of what's really happening out there until I really dived into this world and got started. So I think that it'll be an eye-opening conversation for some who don't realize that, for example, you know, euthanasia in the United States, we know is an issue in shelters, but what a lot of people don't know is how regional and geographic in nature it is. And so we can get into that a little bit in the podcast. But yes, my name is Julian Jabor and the founder of Pet Rescue Pilots. And super excited to be here and talk to you about our Rescue by Relocation program and other programs we have rolling out.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk with you too, man. And before we kind of dive into what it is that you do, can you talk about kind of the origin and about maybe your mind state? What did you do before this and kind of how that all came to be for us?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite quotes is from John Lennon, that life is what happens when you're busy making other plans, so to speak. And one could say that that really is what happened here. I have always been a major aviation and animal enthusiast. And when I say enthusiast, I'm a very passionate person. You know, the things that I enjoy and love, I tend to dive headfirst into them. And so for me, you know, animals and rescue has always been important, and aviation. I mean, I grew up, you know, by the time I was still graduating elementary school, I was playing Microsoft Flight Simulator and flying all over the world. So one could say that the marriage of these two passions was written in the stars. But I work a full-time job. What a lot of people don't know about me is that on the side of running this rescue and flying constantly, I do work full-time, and my flight time is all volunteered. But basically the way this came to be is, you know, I finally got to a position in my life where I had the resources and the time to pursue an aviation education. So I got into my first Discovery flight, and I loved it, honestly, even more than I thought I would. So I very quickly moved through my ratings, and within a year and a half, I was a commercial multi-engine pilot. And, you know, that was done mostly on afternoons and weekends. I'm very fortunate to live in Southern California, where the weather permits us to do our training pretty regularly. Not a lot of weather delays here. So once I got that last commercial multi rating, it kind of became this question of, well, what am I going to do to keep flying? I don't know that I'm the type of person that would enjoy flying for a $500 hamburger. I feel like I need a mission, a purpose. So I started looking for ways to volunteer my pilot skills. And the first thing I came across was that people post rescue transport requirements, you know, asking volunteer pilots to help fulfill them. And I got started flying up and down California, moving dogs, you know, out of the Central Valley into the metropolitan areas, or up and down to forever homes. If, for example, someone adopted a dog or was curious about, you know, a dog that they had seen online and went through their rescue and, you know, got matched up. So that's really how this whole thing got started. But doing that and starting to work with more people in the rescue community allowed me to get what I call the 30,000 foot view on rescue. And I started, you know, branching out, and I met one person in particular that really changed the world for me. And that's Debbie Newton from RSQ 209. We actually met through a very fun story. This was prior to the charity existing, where a dog, Spike, a 10-year-old little poodle guy, had escaped from his backyard in El Paso, Texas on the 4th of July, having been frightened by fireworks. The family looked frantically for him, but he was never found. Fast forward a year later, and the location is Stockton, California. Spike shows up at a vet clinic there. How he got there, nobody knows. Everybody wishes they could have seen what Spike went through in that year. But the bottom line is, through social media, people connected Debbie and I. And, you know, I took the flight out to return Spike to his home in El Paso. And that kind of spurred the transports up to Oregon and Washington, because she had a lot of partners that she worked with up there, and she would do, you know, ground transport. And that's when I started to get very curious, you know, because now all of a sudden a guy who has been doing these flights for like 3-5 dogs at a time up and down California from the Central Valley and outward, I'm getting called to go up to Eugene and Portland and Seattle with 30 dogs at a time. And I'm like, what's going on? So I did my research and my due diligence, and I found something pretty shocking. You know, between 700,000 and 1 million pets are euthanized each year across this country in shelters due to lack of space. That's not a secret. It's not a solid statistic. We don't know exactly where the numbers are, but we know that it can only go up from there in terms of, because these are only the documented cases. But what's interesting is that 50% of those euthanasia events occur in just 5 states. So, for example, California and Texas are both always 1 and 2 on the list. In 2019, California and Texas alone accounted for 250,000. In contrast, we have areas like Washington State or Western Canada, where at this very moment up in Canada, I have partners that have 3,500 rescue, you know, adoption applications and 0 dogs to adopt out. So how is it reasonable to say, well, we've got 2 states in the southern United States that are killing 250,000 dogs and cats a year because there's no space in the shelters. And, you know, just 1,200 miles to the north, nobody can find a dog or cat to adopt. That is how Pet Rescue Pilots started.
Interesting. So really, and that's what I was going to ask is like the, so Pet Rescue Pilots is essentially that puzzle piece in terms of linking these states with where there are thousands of people on wait lists to these states that have, you know, that high, much, much higher euthanasia rates, correct?
Exactly. It's what we call rescue by relocation, that simply by moving companion animals out of these overcrowded areas where most of them will go overlooked, because how it, you know, it's hard not to be overlooked when you're in a big crowd. You know, and moving them to an area where there's just people, tons of people waiting to have a companion animal, they adopt themselves. The majority of our passengers are in forever homes within 2 weeks of arrival at their destination.
And how many years have you been doing Pet Rescue Pilots? I know that you talked about the origin, but how long has it been founded?
So I've been flying pets for coming up to 4 years now. It'll be 4 years in November since I started flying pets. But the organization was founded and began operating in January of 2020, just before the COVID-19 pandemic hit.
And what have you kind of seen, like what's been one, like I know it's kind of a big question, but like what's one memorable story that you have, whether it's, I know that you mentioned, you know, the dog in from El Paso to Stockton, but I'm sure that you meet a lot of like individuals too that probably are really emotional, either, I don't know, or like finding a lost dog or, you know, getting that forever dog, right? What's that like for you in terms of how does that make you feel? And what's one story you can share with us?
It's funny you should ask, because a lot of people have that same question. And they also ask me, like, you know, how is it possible to stay so kind of emotionally level throughout this process when I have some of these really intense stories? Because, you know, we have had dogs that have come through that are not in good condition, medically. You know, we have very serious protocols as far as transmissible disease and vaccination requirements and such for the safety of all the animals, but that's not the only way, you know, these pets suffer medically. Like, we've had a lot of broken limbs, a lot of, you know, blind dogs, deaf dogs, special needs in general. And the reality is that, you know, we're coming up, the next mission we fly will be our 93rd rescue flight. So there's a lot of stories to pick from, but I guess, you know, I stay really mission focused during it. And when it hits me is when we're either in the hotel up in Vancouver or Seattle or wherever it might be, that, wow, we impacted, you know, 30 lives today and hopefully changed them to the bet for the better. One very, very poignant story for me is, and this might be difficult for some to hear, but there was a dog, Valentin, who came into California across the Mexican border. This was quite a ways back. This was back in July of 2019. So this was when I was still operating as an individual, just on my weekend out of pocket, not as a charity. And he had been shot in the face in Tijuana. And there's a specialist surgeon and vet, Compassion Without Borders, up in Santa Rosa. And she took Valentin in and gave him, you know, basically a facial reconstruction. But when I met him, you know, he was covered in blood. He reeked of bacterial infection and was sitting in the back of his crate and looked at me with these eyes of like, I don't understand why this happened. Like, why did people do this to me? All I ever wanted to do was show them love. And that was a very difficult flight for me. But what's incredible is, you know, you look at these dogs after you've flown them and it's been a couple of years, and he was actually adopted by one of the members of her rescue organization. And originally he was a long-term foster, and then she adopted him, and he's absolutely gorgeous. His face is perfectly fine. He's a happy dog going around licking people, playing with other dogs. And like, that is just such a success story. It's very emotional to think about it.
That's amazing. And it just, I think it really is a testament, and it shows what the power of what you're doing. And I know that you mentioned that you're before the call that you're working on, you know, you're rolling out some new things and expanding. And what does that look like? What are some of those things that you're working on, and what do those things do?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'll get to that after I say one last thing, which is that, you know, obviously, you know, we play a big role in what's going on, with these pets, being able to, you know, give 30 dogs a flight to Oregon that takes 3 hours versus a 16, 17 hour drive, is huge. But, we would not be anything without our rescue partners. And so when I founded the organization, I had this dream of a network where we worked with sending partners and receiving partners. And the beauty of the fact that we hold that relationship with both parties is that on a number of occasions, we have been able to connect a sender with a receiver, or we've been able to connect a receiver with a sender, because we kind of are that middleman. But I can't stress enough how much the work that these rescue organizations do before and after the flight is what gets, you know, these dogs the rest of the way there to finding forever homes. I mean, from vet care and prepping them to travel to, you know, getting them socialized and adopted out. It's just, you know, I want to take credit, but the reality is, you know, we fly them. And sure, sometimes we make the connections between rescues, but it's a group effort. It takes a village the whole way.
That's a great attitude. And I couldn't agree more. And I was going to ask you about that, your network, and just how critical that's been and what's that been like growing that, right? I'm sure that it's probably one of those things that you're always making new connections, I would imagine, you know, constantly, right?
Yeah. One of the biggest challenges is that, you know, I'm one guy. I work a full-time job to support myself and I fly on the weekends, you know, and already as it is, like I had to take a couple weeks off this month because it's been 2 years of me flying every weekend, you know, and it turns into an 80-hour work week and you get burnt out after 2 years, believe it or not. So newsflash to me, you know, we are still a small organization. We're only in our second year of running, but I think that the system that we've developed is really effective. The idea that, you know, the transporter is actually acting as the network and the connecting glue between these rescues, because what we're ultimately trying to accomplish is we're trying to shorten the distance between pets that are living in at-risk areas to areas where they would be safe. And so we're able to do that with flight and all of the connections that we've made in all the other areas. But what is difficult is, you know, we get partner requests. Like every day we get a new email with an organization who's found out about us, who wants to partner. And again, you know, one guy, one airplane, weekends, it's very difficult to accommodate everybody. And, you know, one thing that's always been very important to us is ensuring that we're following good safety protocols in the transports and that we're not cutting corners, trying to just, you know, we don't want to do this blindly. We want to be doing this safely and effectively and not putting animals in harm's way by trying to bring them to safety. So it's been a challenge, but our network is quite big as it is. And I've been looking for ways to expand our capabilities with flight. So definitely a lot of things have been going through my head. We've been working through those.
It's going to be exciting to kind of see that unfold. I feel like every organization, every business, they kind of have different bottlenecks and, you know, we all experience it. So it sounds like you're on your way to solving that.
Hopefully. And the reality is, and this is actually a really good segue to your previous question that I didn't quite get to, which is, you know, what else are we rolling out? What have we planned? And I think, you know, right before we started recording, I mentioned to you that, you know, when I founded PRP, the idea was a two-pillar foundation, that we would have two sort of parallel tracks going on. We have Rescue by Relocation, which is what I've named the program, which is the actual transport and the networking of rescues and, you know, being able to move these pets almost like, I mean, I don't want to sound insensitive, but essentially supply chain management, you know, and saving lives by doing it. And then that is an immediate Band-Aid, but that's not addressing the root of the problem. And if we don't address the problem at its root, then this will persist, the overpopulation, the euthanasia, and all of those things. So concurrently, you know, we need to be working on the long term. And the long term is, you know, very much what this podcast is about: raising awareness, educating, advocating for sound legislation. And to be brutally honest with you, if there was enough awareness within our government, like California state legislature has expressed their desire to work on kill rates in the state, and they recognize that in the Central Valley, there's a big problem. And if the government were willing to put funding towards transporting these pets, you know, that's a huge resource. And I know that Western Canada would take hundreds in a heartbeat, for example. So, you know, but that is, how do we get that information up the pole to the right people who say, wow, okay, well, this helps us, you know, effectively reduce euthanasia rates, which is what we're trying to do, or what they've said they're trying to do. And, you know, it's relatively easy and low cost. Also, educating the public is huge too. You know, I don't like to get into the minutia and the debates on whether spaying and neutering your animal is healthy, because I don't believe that it's worth arguing matters of opinion. You know, some people don't have the opinion that it's safe or healthy for the pet to neuter them. And that's entirely fine, but that doesn't mean that you turn the other cheek and let your pet, you know, procreate with every other pet that's unfixed. You don't have to be irresponsible about it. Even if you choose not to spay and neuter your pet, either for financial reasons or because you simply don't believe in that being the right thing to do, you can certainly stop them from mating.
That's a great point. That's a great point. And I think for me too, it's another kind of, I guess, thing that I have a problem with in my area is I see all these people, especially I'm in Southern California too. So it's like, and it's, as you mentioned, it's one of the higher states with euthanasia. And I see all of these people buying these exotic dogs, thousands of dollars. And it's like, I think that if they knew, I think if someone knew that, hey, by you buying that dog, even if it's from an ethical breeder, right, there are dogs that are literally getting put down. And I think awareness is huge. It's huge. And just educating the community and maybe letting them have that thought process go through their mind. Wow, should I buy this expensive dog or maybe take one that and not support that? And I don't know. It's just, and I'm not here to tell someone what to do. It's to have that conversation in their head.
So, absolutely. And, you know, that's a great point. You know, breeders, that's a very, very contentious topic as well.
It is.
And,
it's a bit, yeah, very controversial.
You know, most people would want me as someone who works in rescue to sit there and shame everyone who purchases a pet from a breeder and to really strongly sit there and shout, you know, adopt, don't shop constantly. But the reality is there's two things. Firstly, yes, ethical versus non-ethical breeders, it's huge, but it doesn't make the biggest difference because at the end of the day, we're still breeding and there's lots of dogs who need homes that are sitting there in shelters that are going to be put down. The other thing is, I think that, and this is where my education comes in. For me, I have always been someone who likes to basically appeal to the ethos and to get people to understand that, you know, this is not arbitrary. This is not me saying something from an emotional place, but I'm just trying to show the logic and the ethics behind the decision. You know, for that reason, I think that, you know, we have a good platform for education. Like one of the big staples of what we're going to be talking about with kids is the domestication of the dog. And, you know, kids are such a great canvas to work with in terms of education because their moral compass is surprisingly much better than a lot of full grown adults. You know, they are able to determine right from wrong better than we can sometimes. And, you know, let's talk about the domestication of the dog for a second, right? There were no labradoodles running around in the forest 15,000 years ago. Some people say the earliest, you know, dog is 40,000 years ago. It's all over, but let's say modern domestication, 10, 15,000 years. Like this came, like we have dogs that we have today because thousands of years ago, our predecessors entered into a contract with wolves who were previously their competitors in the wild, right? Like they actually would hunt each other at times. And they said, listen, you don't have to worry about food anymore. You don't have to worry about where your next meal is coming from. We'll give you that. And in exchange, we want help hunting. We want your companionship and loyalty and, you know, the aspects of protection that you bring as well. Dogs are making good on their end of the deal, basically. You know, they're sitting here and they are loyal. Like, you know, you come home after being away for 30 minutes and your dog is going to treat you like you've been gone a lifetime and they've missed you so much. And this is the last day they have with you. However, there are so many people who are okay with the fact that, I mean, maybe not okay, but they don't even know that a million dogs and cats are being euthanized around the country annually. That's not making good on our part of the deal. We didn't domesticate them so that they could be born to be killed, you know? And I think that rather than get into the whole emotional and controversial aspects, if we just said, this is a simple issue, there's a simple solution, we just need everybody's cooperation and everybody to do the right thing, it's a more effective way to get the point across.
Exactly. Yeah, I think so. It comes from a very, I think coming at it that way, it comes from a very intentional and more of a positive place rather than this negative rooted place, which it doesn't matter what the point you're trying to drive across is. If when it's rooted in negativity, it's just, it's not going to be good for anyone. So
100%. Like, I mean, to be honest, a lot of people who purchase pets from breeders, and you know, some will say that that's their fault for being ignorant, but they don't even realize what is going on in shelters. They don't even know it. All they know is they saw a Labradoodle and it's cute and I want one.
100%, man. Exactly. Like that. That's the thing, is that's why I think education is so crucial, where it's like, yeah, you can still go get your dog or Labradoodle or whatever, but maybe now by the education, maybe 20% less people do. And that's right. And that was their decision. You know, like that was just, they have that thought process, that conversation running in their head. And I think it's awesome. I think it all starts with, that's like the root is education. And
that's why the flying pets is great. But at the end of the day, if we get the education done and if we get the advocacy going and we shift this up the ladder, up the poles, you know, to the higher forms of government who see the ethos and the importance of doing right by these animals, you know, we don't have to be the boots on the ground that are even moving them. They can do it. So
that's really cool. Yeah, man. I mean, I feel like we've already talked with a politician out in Delaware, and I would love to talk with one from California. And if we ever do get a hold of one, I would love a panel discussion, and I would love for you, if you'd be interested in coming.
Yeah.
I feel like you have like a really, a very broad background. So, that would be really, I think that would be really cool. So, you know, goals over here.
That would absolutely be an honor. We do have a council member in Los Angeles, Paul Koretz, and he's okay. Really passionate about rescue. And, you know, I don't know why I haven't reached out. I think part of my hesitation has been the COVID-19 pandemic and thinking, you know, boy, like they probably have a lot to deal with.
Probably right now, a lot going on.
Rather wait until we can really, you know, have their attention and everyone can be calm and work on this together. So.
Exactly. No, I like that, man. And, I'm trying to think, is there, I guess if, you know, I want to kind of wrap this up here and just ask, like, if you were to have, if you're, from what you've seen in your 4 years working, what is, if you could add one piece to your business, to your organization, right, to make it run more efficiently, what would that be? Would it be more pilots, more money, more space? What does that look like for you? More partnerships?
I think I've got a list, man. I don't know that one thing would do it, but more pilots, more planes, and more dispatch would be better, because it really does take a lot out of a person to be coordinating, you know, and sometimes our flights, you know, we stop in Fresno or Stockton and pick up, you know, the load for the day. And then we're flying Eugene, Portland, Seattle, Bellingham, Victoria. And so it's a long day and there's a lot of logistics that go into that. So in trying to find another pilot, it's like, who wants to volunteer that much of their time? Most people do not. You know, it's a huge commitment. Your weekend is gone. I haven't had a weekend in 2 years. So, and it's a logistical nightmare. So the person that's doing it has to be really committed to the cause in order to put in the follow through that's required to make this run smoothly. But the dream come true would be, you know, a team of people who are committed, planes and pilots, and yeah, getting it going. Even
that's
bigger.
Awesome. Yeah. Let's get some more pilots. I mean, if I had my pilot's license, I would jump on it in a heartbeat.
Thank you.
But no, man. Yeah. It was great talking with you. And, can you share with us your, like, where can people find you at? Right. Where I know that I know you're on Instagram and a bunch of other ones, but where can people
find you at? Absolutely. Thank you. So, our website is petrescuepilots.org. And that will link to our PayPal for donations. People can sign up to make a monthly donation, which is very helpful to us as well. And then on social media, if you'd like to follow our missions, we document them very closely. I think that that's something that's been very much an asset to us, is the ability to basically display planes and pups, you know, and two things that people are really interested in seeing. So our social media kind of has the same positivity that I was talking about, you know, with getting the message across in a calm and logical manner. So we're Pet Rescue Pilots on Instagram, Pet Rescue Pilots on Facebook. And again, the website is petrescuepilots.org.
Awesome. And all the links to that will be in the description below, wherever you're listening. Julian, thank you so much for coming on. It was great talking with you. Definitely keep me updated. Stay in touch. And thanks a lot for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris. I appreciate it. I look forward to talking next time.